One of the potential coincidences is that the USS Tripoli, with its amphibious landing dock, USS New Orleans, and the 2,200 Marines will be on the 31st. We will be on station on Friday when that second deadline ends. There's also 82nd Airborne Troops, a brigade, I think, at least in here. There's another, the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, steaming in with the USS Boxer. So the question is, what are they going to do? And can you just give us a little sense for whether it's Carg Island or something else? I personally think that Carg Island is just a deception operation. I don't think anybody's actually going to go there because the difficulty would be too high. I don't know. Maybe they will. But whatever. You're talking maybe 5,000 Marines with the two MEUs and another few thousand from the 82nd Airborne. What can those organizations, what can that much ground combat power, along with the A-10s and the Apache helicopters, which have been sent over to support whatever they're going to do on the ground, what is feasible militarily for them to do?
It's important for Americans to understand something. What you do as a soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine after you arrive is much more important than how fast you get there. Right now, the emphasis is on light and fast. Why are we sending a brigade for the 82nd? Well, because we can. You load up 3,000 men. Now, of course, the Army, as always, has said, well, if we're going to send a brigade, we have to have a division headquarters on the ground to manage it. So 3,000 troops need a two-star general with a one-star general as deputy and probably 150, 200, maybe more people to plan and conduct operations. This is a sort of standard, you know, World War II nonsense that we go through. And then the Marines. We're going to put Marines there because we can float them in, and then we can put them somewhere. Well, the problem is once you put the paratrooper on the ground, once you put the Marine on the ground, the Ranger, whoever it is, what are they going to do? What can they do? Are they going to seize and hold something of great value? What is the seizure about? If they go to an island, can they hold that island? Well, I think we're finding out that islands are extremely vulnerable. Unless it's the size of Borneo, that means that all sorts of precision strike missiles and unmanned systems can annihilate everything on the island. So if you think you're going to go on an island and then hold it for what? What's the benefit? How does it help you? And see, from the Iranian standpoint, they're probably sitting there asking themselves, how could we be this stupid? And we shouldn't get confused. We're not saying that Marines or soldiers or anybody else are not good, solid people that are well-trained and reasonably well-led, I hope, and disciplined. It's not the point. Is what are they going to do when they get there? And how much can you expect of them? So that's why I go back to this thing, and well, we'll seize the islands. Now, if you look at the straits, and this is very hot, very important, I just wrote a piece on Substack that goes into some detail on this. If you know, you go through all the thinking and then you say, well, I'm going to introduce ground troops and I'm going to seize the straits. What does that mean? If you look at the sides of the strait, in other words, the coastline, you're talking about 1,000 feet of cliff. In other words, this is an uphill climb in the worst sense of the word. Are you then going to land troops further to the east and then make the long march around and take it from the landward side? I mean, what are you doing? If you're going to put them on an island, once they're sitting on the island, what kind of control or influence are they going to assert? And the answer is none, because the place will be pulverized. It'll be covered by rockets and missiles. Anything on it will be exterminated. I mean, that's the easy thing to do. What else would you do? Now, of course, if you're going to make the argument that the Iranians are running out of missiles, which reminds me of the Russian army running out of missiles and rockets and so forth, then maybe it's fine. Maybe you could go there and open the chaise lounge chair and take in some sun. But the point is, I don't think so. And I don't think that you can stop from 150 kilometers away all sorts of weapons being launched against those sites. And again, we're back to persistent surveillance. What are you going to do that's going to fool anybody? Where are you going to stage forces? Are you going to try and stage them in Kuwait, in Bahrain? Are you going to try and stage out of Oman? I doubt seriously the Omanis will be receptive to that idea. Are you going to try and stage out of the UAE? Anywhere you go where you try to mass forces, It's going to be picked up. It's going to be targeted. And you're going to be brought under effective fire. So the problem with all of this is, do we have these capabilities? Yeah, there we got lots of light infantry. Much of it's good. It'll go where you send it. But what are you asking it to do? And I think at the moment, we're asking them to do the impossible, to exert control over geography that they can't control. It's not a question of, are there not enough of them? It's simply a question of surveillance and strike. And if you don't have that advantage, if you can't rob the enemy of ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and you can't defeat his intermediate range or tactical ballistic missiles and so forth, what are you going to do? Perhaps we're going to have to go through this in order to learn this lesson the hard way.
And just real briefly, what about this? Because there's a lot of things swirling around and a lot of the rumor mills that actually these troops, especially these light fighters, are actually being sent to do a seizure operation to get those 400 kilograms of reprocessed material and prevent Iran from ever turning them into a nuclear bomb. What is the possibility? We have a lot of good people that can do things. We've seen how they SEAL Team 6 went and took out bin Laden. We've seen how we just took Maduro out here. Can something like that work?
Well, there's gold in the Amazon jungles. Why don't you go find it? Good luck. That's, you're looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. Now, you can try and detect things using satellite imagery as well as other means of detection overhead to see whether or not you found something that's radioactive. but I'm not sure you're going to end up with what you're looking for. It doesn't take that much material to alert somebody in space or flying overhead. What if you alert on 15, 20 places? Do you line them up and go to them in succession? How do you get there? Are you going to fly in a helicopter? Helicopters are so vulnerable. You can knock them down with rocks. So how do you get in and get out without being detected? And that's the biggest problem I have with all of these assumptions. The other thing is, I read recently, somebody said, we may need as many as 200,000 troops. If you go back to the Dardanelles in 1915, it started really in earnest in February of 1915. It lasted for 9 months. They went in initially, these are the straits between Turkey and Europe, what we call the Bosporus. And the idea was that you seize the straits so that you could pass the Royal Navy through. They can then take Constantinople, now Istanbul, under direct fire. You can land more troops and seize the capital and knock the Turks out of the First World War. It was very attractive. Everybody thought this was a great idea. Well, not everybody. The chief of naval operations thought it was insane, but Churchill, who was effectively the Secretary of the Navy, overrode him and said, no, this will be successful. Churchill did these kinds of things routinely. If he didn't agree, he just dismissed expert opinion and then would go off on these tangents and do incredibly stupid things. The Dardanelles operation was a good example. And there were something like 20 forts, fortified positions, up and down the straits the Turks had built with heavy artillery. Then on top of that, you had over 300,000 Turkish troops that showed up. Beyond that, you had mines of all different types and kinds, mines that sank three battleships and a numerous other supporting vessels. Ultimately, they ended up with 500,000 men on the Gallipoli Peninsula, 500,000 troops, mostly British, some New Zealanders, some Australians, British Indian Division, which seldom gets mentioned. It deserves credit. They fought well. And some Frenchmen, 500,000 men. It was a disaster because, once again, you were going uphill. And the Turks held the high ground. The Turks lost 87,000 men killed. I don't know how many the British and others lost, but it's probably pretty close to that.
48,000, actually. I looked that up the other day.
The Turks won. And how could they lose? It was impossible to defeat them, given the terrain and the circumstances. So what I'm trying to get across is, people seem to have read the story of the Dardanelles, but they didn't read the whole way through. They read the first few chapters, said, oh, this is a great idea, let's do it. Didn't bother to read the concluding chapter, which was catastrophic failure. It was a dumb idea. What they're talking about trying to do with ground troops in the Straits of Hormuz, in my judgment, is an equally dumb idea. Unless, of course, I could be wrong about this, you have annihilated all of the intermediate range and tactical ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. You have eliminated all of the unmanned systems that could be basically launched and hurled at you, so that the place is barren. And then, even more important, perhaps you can jam all the satellites, Chinese and Russian and others, that are providing assistance and support and imagery to the Iranians. If you can do all of those things, then I suppose you can put people on the ground with rifles walking around looking at the neighborhood. Will that give you control of the straits? Well, that depends on whether or not you got all the underwater unmanned vessels and systems, whether you have killed sufficient numbers of speedboats, whether or not, you know, go down the list.
Yeah.
Everybody forgets that before we went into Normandy, there was almost no German air force left in Western Europe. Everybody forgets this. You know, we wanted to land in 1942. Then we wanted to land in 43. And each time the British wisely distracted us and said, forget it. We have no chance of coming ashore. There's an event called Dieppe. Some of your listeners or in the audience may want to go look this up. In 1942, the Canadians insisted ferociously, we know we can beat the Germans. Let us land. And they landed with a few thousand men, and they were slaughtered. And they brought tanks and everything else, and they were destroyed. And the Germans sank everything. By the time we landed in Normandy in June of 1944, there were only two fighters in the German Air Force capable of lifting off and fighting us. In 1943, before this had occurred, there were hundreds of fighters, even thousands left that could have done enormous damage to us, and thousands of top flight troops. But everything was on the Eastern Front. There wasn't much left in the West. And what was there? Well, it just wasn't top of the line. We don't even point these things out. We don't understand how things really went down. And by the way, even with all the advantages that we had created, we had 5,000 fighters in the air over Normandy. Even with that, the Germans held us up for over a month. And at one point, it looked like they could drive us into the sea. So we need to understand these kinds of operations are extremely dangerous, very difficult to conduct. And I hope somebody somewhere is telling these things to the president.